Chuck Anderson, and I want to welcome you to our 55-minute talk show today. This is a special day for us because we've never had an astronaut on the show before, and I'm really looking forward to our visit with Army Colonel, an astronaut with the NASA program, Chuck Gamer. What will make this program extra special is that Colonel Gamer is also from South Dakota, and we'll try to find out more about his being raised in Scotland later in the show. Right now, though, I know I've got some questions I've always wondered about in regards to space travel, especially from a man that's not only left this planet once, but has been on two space missions since November of 1990. Colonel, I know you've got a lot of listeners right now that are from Scotland, so we want to welcome them to our show today, as we do also to you. I guess I've always wondered what it's like for an astronaut the night before they take off into space. Your first space mission was November 15th, 1990. What thoughts went through your mind the night before liftoff?
Sure. Well, I think that, I can only relay my own personal experience, and I'm sure that everything, each individual astronaut feels, has a unique experience that is truly their own. But I think for me, the night before launch is really the hardest part of the whole flight. Because it's the only opportunity, or it is the first opportunity, where you've really got time on your hands to think about what's about to take place in the morning. By this time now, you've said goodbye to your family and friends, and you've got about 8 hours before you're going to go to sleep now on this night, what turns out to be the eve of your flight. And to mentally prepare yourself for what's about to take place the next day, I think that the fact that this is always a risky program has to enter your mind, and of course the fact that
when you say risk, could we stop right there?
Sure.
At the talk this morning, you did give some percentages of getting up, and the percentages could you just mention those right now?
Well. It all depends on whose study you believe, but basically most of the studies say that there's a 1 in 35 chance or that we will experience a major catastrophic failure every 35 flights. Now, fortunately, our history has been much better than that. But remember, of course, in 86 we had the Challenger accident and lost 7 people. So those kinds of things weigh pretty heavily on your mind. And when you consider the fact, and I know that I have family probably in the listening audience, so I maybe shouldn't even bring these statistics out. But of the 197 astronauts that have been selected, about 1 in 15 has not lived to see their career, to see a normal retirement from that office. They have been killed in accidents in training for spaceflight or in spaceflight itself. So that percentage is really pretty high.
And I didn't mean to stop you there, but I thought it would be good to stop as you were relating these percentages. You're laying in bed, and this is kind of going through your mind. Now we know what you were thinking about.
Well, sure. I never take any kind of medication to assist to take the edge off, so to speak, the night before, any sleep medications or anything. So I just... first couple hours you basically toss and turn and you get 4 good hours of sleep, and then the last 2 hours you toss and turn but when they come in and wake you up that morning for the launch, now everything it's really changed. Your whole focus has now changed. You're only concerned about what do you have to do on this day to be successful. You know what you've trained to do. Now it's time to go out there and do it. Nobody has to tell you what to do. You get up and you go shower and shave and take care of all the personal hygiene things and go off and have breakfast. And the next event after that is to go down and get suited up. The mission specialists go down and start the suit up process. And the pilot and the commander getting a weather brief at this time. And one of the mission specialists is also getting that weather brief. And now this is really the first phase in the preparation for the flight on that day. And nobody has to tell you, like I said, you're so focused on the events of that day that you don't have time for nervousness. You don't have time for concern. You only are concentrating on your job.
As you were mentioning to the crowd this morning, at what point did the Lena joke stop?
Well, the mood is pretty light in the cockpit. We haven't got to the vehicle yet, and that's probably, where... where we have the first opportunity to relax a little bit before flight. We are actually loaded into the vehicle about an ingress of vehicle about 3.5 hours before liftoff. So for 3.5 hours, we're on our back sitting there in the vehicle. And so the mood is like I said, is very light at this point. And again, we had Jim Buckley from West Fargo, North Dakota on there. Between the Nodax and the Sodax, we told all the Lena Nolan jokes in the book, I think.
Wow. Now we're about 3 hours to go. And you call it a vehicle. When I was a kid back, I was born in the 30s during the Depression years, and we had a couple of real heroes. We had Buck Rogers and we had Flash Gordon, and they just called them spaceships. And every time I notice that you professionals use the word vehicle, I always want to say, let's call it what it is. It's a spaceship.
Well, I guess it's that's for us. It's it is a spaceship as well, but we always refer to it as a vehicle. We're creatures of habit, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you're well trained. Now, it's are we into a major countdown now? We've got 3 hours to go or so. Is this a major countdown? Like it's pretty well to go?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Actually, this countdown started about 72 hours prior to this point. The Launch Control Center and the Mission Control Team, Launch Control Center in Florida and the Mission Control Center team in Houston, as well as the backup Mission Control Centers, they're fully manned now. They've been manned for several hours. Of course, the vehicle is tracking down. They've already loaded the vehicle with propellant. We've got 500,000 gallons of hydrogen and oxygen in the tanks now.
Wow.
So, I mean, you're sitting on what is going to become now, in a few more hours, a controlled explosion into space.
A super large skyrocket.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's, you've got 4 million pounds of propellant there that are going to push you off into orbit.
And within those last 3 hours, is there a lot that is asked upon you, or is it pretty well computer at that point? Are they constantly talking to you at this point?
The pace is pretty steady. The computers, onboard computers, don't take on or take over for until about 37 seconds before liftoff.
We're visiting with a real astronaut, and I'm so delighted, Lieutenant Colonel Gaymar. Am I saying it right?
Yep.
I sure wouldn't want to mispronounce that. We're going to be back in 1 minute. Going to take a break right now, sir. We'll be back. This is Personalities with Chuck Anderson. Chuck Anderson, and I'm with Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Sam Gaymar, astronaut, and I'm just in awe, Colonel, and I can't get used to calling you any other word but Colonel. I, being Marine Corps and very disciplined soldier as I am, we have a NASA blue jumpsuit. He's sitting here. It says Sam Gaymar with the American flag on there, and we have, I can't read that. What's that say up here?
Well, that's the name of the crew members. Each crew designs their own mission patch. So these are the mission patches that we designed before we flew.
Oh.
So the names that you see on there are the names of the crew members on those flights.
I almost missed a very important detail there. I'm glad I asked. The other patch down there, what's that say?
Well, this, again, is the mission patch from the first flight. And you see it's got a gold starburst on the top. And a gray mirror image of that on the bottom, as well as two orbiters that are mirror images of each other.
And the patch on your right shoulder.
Well, that's NASA meatball. That's our NASA patch.
And the one up here that says Mach 25?
Yeah, the Mach 25 patch is only given to those air crew members who have gone 25 times the speed of sound.
That leaves us out, us guys that drive I-80.
I tell you, unless, of course, you made it past me. Maybe that was you. You probably get a Mach 2 patch or something.
That was me that you thought was a meteor. I was there this morning. You said when that meteor, and we'll get back to the meteors that went right underneath you on one of your entries.
That's right.
We have 3 hours to go. We want to set the premise again. And I can picture you laying back and nothing to do. What do you guys do for those 3 hours?
Well, there's, we are laying on our backs. It's not a very comfortable position to be in. And so you do have some muscle soreness and some discomfort there as you sit. And remember, you're sitting like you were in a chair, except you're rotated 90 degrees up. So if the back of the chair were on the floor instead of the legs, that's how you would be positioned here for the next 3.5 hours. You've got a parachute on your back. You've got oxygen bottles strapped to your side along with a harness across your chest.
Could I interrupt you for a second? I didn't realize that they had parachutes on.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we have the capability to bail out of the orbiter if required. But again, we have to be in controlled gliding flight.
Is this something new since the accident that we had some time back?
Yes, after the Challenger accident, we developed this new capability. And what it is we have what we call an escape pole. It's mounted in the mid-deck and close to the hatch. And if it becomes a situation where we are not going to make a landing site for whatever reason, and we're in controlled gliding flight, then we jettison the hatch, we blow the hatch, and deploy this pole. And that, then we have lanyards that attach to that thing that will slide down this pole. And of course, the parachute then will automatically open once we get at a low enough altitude, around 14,000 feet.
When that major accident happened where they were just climbing up, now is this where you can bail out?
No, unfortunately, there's no bailout capability while the solid rocket boosters are still burning. So really, you have to be off of the boosters, you have to be off the external tank, and we have to be in controlled gliding flight. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to be over land. We can be out over the ocean. If we bail out over the ocean, we do have a survival pack that we carry that's part of the parachute, and as soon as we hit the water, we have salt-activated CO2 cartridges that inflate the life raft and the harness as well.
So right now, during this last 3 hours, you're laying on top of all this stuff.
Yeah, that's a fact. So that's partly why it's not a very comfortable position. And they keep us fairly busy. It's not such an aggressive schedule that it's taxing, but it's a constant pace as we march in now towards liftoff. There's certain things that have to be done. We have to set some additional cockpit switches. We have to activate the backup computer system. We have to transition them now for ascent, and all of those things are taking place now during that three-hour period.
At your talk this morning, you said at a point now the ship starts to rock. I want to keep calling it a ship. Is that okay? Let me have a fantasy here. At what point was it starting to get a vibration?
Well, as we count down at 3 minutes and 40 seconds before liftoff, we've already started the auxiliary power units. And at three minutes and 40 seconds before liftoff, the main engines, which are these large bells, engine bells in the back, they're as big as a man, 6-7 feet in diameter, they go through a gimbal sequence. So they slam against the stops on all four corners as they exercise them to make sure that we have flight control. And as they hit those stops, they shutter that whole vehicle. They just shutter all the way to the top of the stack. Now, you're 125 feet above this thing sitting on the top of that stack.
I can feel it right now.
Oh, sure, and it shutters all the way back down. And you can feel that vibration. Now you're pretty sure that you guys are in for a big event here shortly.
And that's when the Lena story stopped.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, they've probably stopped now about 6 minutes before liftoff because now things are getting real busy. We're starting auxiliary power units, so... So once we get within about T-minus 9 minutes, the mood is pretty serious.
Okay, the date is November 15th, 1990, and we've got 60 seconds and we've got 45 seconds. What's going through your mind, sir?
Well, within a minute, basically, there's no conversation in the cockpit. At T-minus 1 minute and counting.
Is that a rule?
Well, no, it's not a rule. It's just
nobody wants to do it.
That's a fact. Everybody's concentrating now so hard on the task at hand that there's no time for extraneous discussions. So at T-minus 1 minute, you've got the visors closed. You're on your own internal O2, pseudo O2 oxygen, and everybody is concentrating now only on their systems. There's no there's no extraneous conversation.
I'm getting nervous just listening to this.
But yeah, the mood is now very serious.
Now it's 10, 9. At what point do you feel that giant power underneath you?
at 7 seconds before liftoff, the main engines come up to speed, and they have to be at 100% power before the solid rocket booster command will be sent. And at liftoff, of course, solid rocket boosters ignite, and there's no doubt in your mind the significant event in your life has just occurred.
What's it feel like now? Is the major vibration at the beginning, or is it a little later?
Well, initially, the noise level starts to come up. The vibration is starting to be felt, and this whole vehicle rocks forward about 6 feet and comes back top dead center.
And this is called a cliffhanger. We're going to leave our radio listeners, especially those guys driving the trucks down there at I-90 right now, says, I got to pull off and eat. We're going to say what's going to happen in one moment, but we want to remind you, you're listening to Personalities with Chuck Anderson. We're back. This is Chuck Anderson. We're visiting with astronaut Chuck Amer. Okay, the cliffhanger. We've just had ignition. We've got this roar. We've got this fantastic sound. And we're going into a thing called a lean, which means what?
Well, because of where the main engines, their center of thrust is, it actually rocks the whole stack. When I talk about the whole stack, I'm talking about the external tank, solid rocket boosters, and the orbiter. It rocks this whole thing forward. About 6 feet where we're sitting, we feel that whole thing rock forward about 6 feet. You can see, as you look to your left out the windows, you can see the launch complex there, the steel structure. Of course, it stays put, and you see this whole thing rock forward, and you think, oh, my God. But when you basically come back top dead center, then the solid rocket boosters light off, and you're along for the ride now.
Like in the movies, can you feel the skin going back? Are you taking a lot of G's?
Well, you're not taking so many G's. We only pull about a G and a half at liftoff. We on the pad we weigh 4.4 million pounds, and vehicle has a little over 6.5 to 7 million pounds of thrust. So we're only pulling a G and a half, but that vehicle is struggling to get out of the atmosphere. I mean, it's just shaking you apart. It's shaking fore and aft and laterally. And making, obviously there's a lot of noise, there's a crackling sound as the solid rocket boosters are it's almost like like a cellophane, kind of a crackle. If you took a piece of cellophane and crackled it, that's a kind of a sound you hear. And this will continue, of course, for the next 2 minutes and 5 seconds while that thing is burning solid rocket boosters to get you out of the atmosphere.
Now, you don't really, what you told the crowd this morning, now I'm just going to assume that you were joking because you're losing your hair up there. Well, you told them that the way you lost your hair is you have to go out and light the fuse?
Yeah, that's how that thinned out. But not really. So the onboard computers control the ignition sequence. At 37 seconds before liftoff, the main computers take over all the onboard systems. And they sample, obviously, all kinds of things. They sample valve positions. They sample fuel flows. They sample oxygen mixtures. There's just untold thousands of samplings being taken now at this point, and in thousands of seconds. I mean, those samples are being taken every thousandth of a second. And when they sense that everything is properly configured for liftoff and that all the engines have now got good starts and that they're all healthy, they issue the command to light the solid rocket boosters.
Was it about 2 minutes and some seconds? Is that the pretty critical stage? I know that was for the Challenger. If you get past that, do you feel really good?
Well, once you get rid of solid rocket boosters, there's a big sigh of relief because the liquid control, the liquid engines, the liquid fuel engines, the hydrogen and oxygen engines, we have some control over those. Solid rocket boosters, once you light them, you basically, you're on for the ride.
Are you pretty well now a real technician? Are you starting to work now at this point?
Well, you're monitoring all the systems. The vehicle is actually being flown through the internal guidance, but you are monitoring all systems, and we have had failures going uphill on my first.
Oh, uphill. I like that term, uphill.
Sure. On the first flight, we did not experience any failures going uphill, but on the second flight, we did have a avionics cooling system that failed. And, of course, cooling is obviously critical to the avionics. You start getting concerned about black boxes failing. So we had to do some activation steps under powered flight. All those kinds of things are difficult given the G environment and the vibration and the noise environment that you're working in at this point. But But again, that's what we train to do.
And you reached up how high on that flight? Was it 340 miles? Am I close?
Well, we went 308 nautical, which was probably in the range of, in the neighborhood of 370 statute miles, 340 to 370 statute.
And that cooling system, I know, is important because you were mentioning to us this morning in our little class where you had your movies and everything, that it can be, what, 400 degrees on the sun side of the planet and down to about 400 degrees below zero on the dark side?
Oh, sure, yeah. You can see, you know, wide temperature variations. I would say plus or minus 250 degrees is not uncommon. And again, it all depends on whether you're sun-facing or deep space-facing.
I like the way that you were talking about being able to sleep up there. There's no, how did you say it? There's no hot spots?
Right, yeah, your body is fully supported. It's in a weightless environment. And I had good restful sleep during all 10 days that I've had on orbit. We work 16 hours and have 8 hours off each day. So I was ready for bed every time.
Now, when you have the 8 hours off, of course, we all like to get 8 hours sleep. Up there, the adrenaline is flowing. Do you really need the eight, or do you tell yourself, yes, I must sleep?
Well, I think it varies from day to day. Some days you're totally exhausted, and other days you feel a little fresh, and you might spend a little more time doing earth viewing or something like that. But I think overall I was tired and ready for the sleep period.
Yeah, 16 hours a day. Now you get qualified for time and a half on that?
Oh yeah, I'm paid as a military officer. There's no time and a half.
It still seems unusual to see our NASA people to still think of them as military, because you are a genuine Army officer. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Lieutenant Colonel in the Army.
And if you were to, for some reason, leave the NASA program, you'd be right back in the Army as probably what?
Well, that's a good question. I would probably be working in the Space Division someplace within the Army or Strategic Defense Command under the Strategic Defense Initiative, more than likely.
On your 1990 mission, was there anything that was sort of scary besides the potential of the coolant problem?
No, I don't think that there were particularly anything that there were surprises. The powered flight, of course, is always risky. And when the main engine's shut down fine and you're safely on orbit, that's always a good feeling. That's the first opportunity really to relax and think about it.
As you're ready to enter Earth, we're talking about temperatures of 2,500 degrees outside?
Yeah, that temperature range depends on where you're looking at the vehicle, but they can get as high as 2,500 degrees. Inside the orbiter, it's still pretty close to 80 degrees. It's controlled internally about 80 degrees.
And in your movies, it was showing the windows actually turning white.
Oh, yeah. They initially start out red hot, go to orange hot, white, and you see these white flashes and big fireballs over the top of the window.
Thank you very much, Chuck Anderson. This is so exciting. I'll be right back in one moment. This is Chuck Anderson visiting with a man far more famous than I, with the same name, Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Sam Gaymar. For those of you that have just tuned in, we want to tell you, you've missed a really first half wonderful, wonderful show. We've had this gentleman just lift off the planet, and we've been up there about 300 and some miles, and now we got to get you back home. Let's take it from there.
Okay. As we get ready to prepare for deorbit, there's several things, obviously, that have to be done. We have to close the payload bay door. We have to bring in any antennas that we deployed for communication with the ground. So all those kinds of things are taken care of. We reconfigure the flight deck. We reconfigure the computers. And all those kinds of things are done internally in preparation for landing. We stop on-orbit operations. We close up the things like the galley and the waste control containment station and do all our stowage so that we don't have any loose items as we come in. We set up our seats and our emergency equipment. We go ahead and remount the escape pole in the event that an unfortunate event that we should ever have to use it. And so all those kinds of orbiter reconfiguration problems or things are now complete, and we're ready to do the deorbit burn. The deorbit burn has actually started a half a world away, so to speak. It's over India when we do the deorbit, typically, over the Indian Ocean, typically. And at this point now, you're going to slow the vehicle down just enough to come home. Just give you an idea about how fast that is. You know, when we're on orbit, we're moving about the Earth at 5 miles a second. You know, that's almost nine times faster than a speeding bullet from a rifle, high-powered rifle.
Even faster than I on the interstate.
Even faster than that. That's a fact. And it doesn't take much now to slow us down for gravity to take over. So when we're rotating, like I said, about 26,000 feet per second up there, we only have to slow down about 500 feet per second. So we have to go from 26,000 feet per second to 25,500 feet per second. That little bit of difference in there will cause us now to slow down enough to re-enter the atmosphere. Gravity will now just pull us back in. So we do that burn someplace again over the Indian Ocean, about a half a world apart. And at 4,200 miles away from the landing site, we start to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. And initially, the way we control our energy, we start out with more than we need. And I say energy, remember, we're a glider now. So we have to be at a certain airspeed and a certain altitude at different points throughout this trajectory, this entry trajectory. But we control that by doing a number of S turns across the final approach path, which is some 4,200 miles long. And eventually we get over the field and circle back around and come into land. That's our final opportunity to adjust our energy.
And you only have one shot.
That's a fact.
So I might be graded, who knows, on the talk this morning. I remember you said that if you came in and you didn't have enough power, you can come right straight in and land. If you had too much power and you were too high, what do you do then?
Well, if we have too much energy, and again, when we talk about, you talk about power, I talk about it as energy, because we don't have any engines running, so it's all potential and kinetic energy. And so if we have too much energy, we can make the circle to land a little bit larger. If we don't have enough energy, we can make it smaller, or ultimately we can just come in and land straight in.
What's it feel like when you feel those wheels touch?
Well, I think that the touchdown, of course, is always a relief. Actually, the wheel stop is even more of a relief than touchdown, because you still have to derotate the nose, and you still have to bring this vehicle to a controlled stop. And on my first flight, that was at the Kennedy Space Center on a runway, on a concrete runway. And remember, this thing has got moats on both sides with hungry alligators. So it's always nice when the wheels come to complete stop and you don't have any more danger of a blown tire or anything that may take you off the side of the runway.
I keep thinking of a guy who just would have given his eye teeth to have been here this morning. You are so funny and congenial and a wonderful speaker, is Wes Peppers. He would have given anything to be in this room today with us, listening to you. I remembered one thing I thought was pretty incredible. You have all sorts of backup ways of firing when you come in. Can you tell us all of those backup systems?
Well, sure. It takes, we do have several backup systems, and all of those things are redundantly powered. But for example, we have two deorbit maneuvering engines, and we only need one of those. However, if one should fail, of course, we would go to the back to the second one. Typically, we burn both of them. We only need one. If they both should fail, well, then the option is to what we call do a down mode to the RCS, which is a reaction control system. We would now fire the jets in the aft section of the orbiter that control the attitude while we're on orbit. And they're not as efficient. They don't have nearly the amount of thrust. But eventually they will get us slowed down enough so that we can re-enter the atmosphere.
You had a good question on the ozone layer. Can you share that with us today?
Well, the one question I think was about the atmosphere and whether or not it's a uniform atmosphere. And the answer, of course, is no, it's not. I mean, we have significant variations in the atmosphere, both the distance from the Earth's surface, how far out it extends, what the density of it is, And so you see all of those, and all of those are important during this entry phase, because we don't know what the characteristics of the atmosphere are on that day. We can only best guess for that season. So in the summertime, we have a certain atmospheric model. For fall, we have a certain one. For winter, we use a different one. In spring, again, based on those four seasons. So if you have significant different changes in the atmosphere within that season, you can end up being short on energy.
Which mission was it where the meteor went underneath you?
That was on the second mission, STS-48, when we were coming in over the east coast of the United States and looking back towards Florida. You could see this meteor re-enter the atmosphere underneath you. That's always a strange sight to see. We're so used to looking up into a night sky and seeing meteors re-enter.
I saw the pictures, and I'm sure that our NASA scientists can figure out how big that meteor was. Has anybody mentioned how big it was?
No, I just don't have a clue as to the size of it.
Not a clue. With all that scientific know-how at everybody's fingertips, tell them that you had a guy that asked this question, wondering how big that meteor was. Do you think it was bigger than a bread box?
It's hard to say.
Really?
Exactly.
Like it could have been very small, the size of a fist, or it could have been very large?
Yeah, just don't have a... Again, I just don't have a feel for how large it could be.
There's Laura, our production director, and Laura is really tough. Did you notice how she finally just showed me the clock right in front of my face and told me that it's time, that we've got to take a break? Don't go away, Mr. Astronaut. Don't go away. This is Chuck Anderson, and we'll be right back. Thanks. This is Chuck Anderson. We're back with my favorite astronaut, anyway, out of the NASA program, Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Sam Gamer. I'm so proud that I got it correctly. And I'm just awed. I'm still looking at this American flag on your sleeve, this blue jumpsuit. And now we get to come back to how fate reached out to put a person like you into a status of twice leaving this planet. And we're very glad that you successfully came home. We also remember you on the radio. Weren't you one of the people on the last program? Didn't we hear your voice?
That's right. I was working as what we call a capsule communicator, or CAPCOM, in the Mission Control Center. So once we, and of course I was the spacewalk communicator as well. I was the EVA communicator during that mission as well. So when things did not go particularly well the first couple attempts, of course I went into the replanning mode, along with what we called Team 4, headed up by a guy by the name of the flight director's name was Ron Dittamore, and Ron is a flight director, and I, as a capsule communicator, had assembled a team to go off and try and come up with a new plan.
And we're all glad that that came out as well as it did. It shows human ingenuity, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is a program that I think that all Americans be truly proud of, because these engineers really give their heart and their soul to come up with brilliant solutions, and given the opportunities, they will.
We'll never be replaced by robots or computers, will we?
Never.
Let's go back to the year 1955. Born right here in South Dakota was a new baby Charles, baby boy, Gamer, and was born actually in Yankton, although his parents were grocers in Scotland, South Dakota, which makes this visit with you doubly important for me, because you're a South Dakota product. The last several governors have been trying to push these products made in South Dakota. So we could probably, among all those patches, somebody could send you one that says, Dakota, would you wear it? I don't know. He's just laughing. I don't know what that meant. Wouldn't they let you wear that up on maybe another moon mission or something?
Oh, I'm sure they would.
Made in South Dakota. 1955. Now, you went all the way through the Scotland school system, graduated in 1973, Scotland High School. At what point from 1955 until 7 years ago did you realize you were going to be an astronaut, or hope to be?
Well, there we go. I was going to say... I didn't think I ever realized it until the day that I got the call. I guess from, as a young boy growing up, I had hoped that maybe ultimately one day I'd have that opportunity. I always wanted to fly, and I thought that flying as an astronaut would be the ultimate flight experience. And so It's not kind of anything that you shared very often. Kids say lots of things and want to be lots of things. So, it's sometimes hard to separate the wheat from the chaff. And so it's not anything you kind of share. But I had kept it in the back of my mind and always thought that, well, why not? And when I got to college, really is where I started working.
And that was where?
Well, that was in the military academy at West Point.
And but didn't you do a little stint with the Army before that?
Well, I spent a couple of years enlisted as an enlisted soldier in the Army. And
you got to see how the real guys work, huh?
Well, yeah, I thought that was a reasonable thing to do, because I actually did want to have I did want to get a commission in the Army as a lieutenant, and I thought, well, by golly, if you're going to lead these guys, you ought to know what they do for a living. So that's why I enlisted, really. At the time, thinking back, I can't hardly believe it, but that was my thought process at 17, and I did that and had a good time. I had a great experience as an enlisted soldier, and I would do it again. I'd recommend it to anybody. But I ultimately decided that I wanted to pursue my degree and went off to West Point, where had applied and was accepted and got a Department of the Army nomination to West Point. And that's really where I started working pretty aggressively towards this goal. I had a lot of encouragement from instructors and that helped. Like I said, they were helpful both personally and professionally in pursuit of this career.
If I remember correctly now, getting into Annapolis or West Point or the Air Force Academy, I think you got to have at least one letter from a senator that'll recommend you. Isn't that correct?
And there's a couple of different ways, but for the most part, that's true. The Army reserves about 180 appointments from within the Army for active duty, and about 180 reserve appointments from the Army National Guard and Reserve, as well as, of course, then your congressmen have their authorized slots as well. Although I had nominations I remember at least Jim Abner. I don't remember if I had nominations from the other congressmen. I'm pretty convinced that I did.
Who cares now? You've made it.
But my appointment ultimately came from the Department of the Army.
Yeah. Were you a good student at West Point?
Well, I was the first student at West Point. Everything is relative. I'll never tell.
Okay. No, nobody's listening. It's okay. It's just four of us in this room right now.
No, I did. I enjoyed my experience at West Point. It was, college should be an academic as well as social environment. And so I played hard and worked hard.
Do any sports?
All intramurals while I was there. Just spent a lot of time spent a lot of time out flying airplanes while I was there, and powered flight seminars, and I was president of the flying club there my last year, and was president of the AIAA there, which is basically an engineering organization, aerospace, I enjoyed my experience, and it prepared me well for ultimately joining the ranks of the Army as a professional Army aviator.
Did you ever have any model airplanes when you were young?
Well, I had a few models growing up, although not a great deal of them.
That isn't the president calling for you, is it?
Oh no, I don't think so.
Okay.
I was thinking it was probably for you, Chuck, but.
The model airplanes, I saw some beautiful ones going up this morning. I thought perhaps you would have had, that was kind of a launching point for you, or rockets.
Well, actually, I had a gas-powered airplane, the type that's on the string, that has the controls on the wire.
Yes.
And my dad shouldn't be listening, but we took it out there Christmas Day. And it basically diverted on, or I mean, it failed on us, and we plowed that thing into the ground. It broke in a million pieces.
God, does your dad know that?
Oh yeah, he remembers, I'm sure.
Oh, you are a wonderful guest. I even hate to break away, and our hour has just about slipped by. We want to remind everybody you're listening to Personalities with Chuck Anderson. We'll be back in one moment. We're back. This is Chuck Anderson. with Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Gamer. Astronaut, as I look at you, Colonel, and as I mentioned this morning, I was watching you in your presentation that you gave to the public. That was that first one. I had to get up early to get out here at, what was that, 9:30 this morning?
Yeah, I was impressed when I saw you out there.
Thanks. And I was dressed up, too.
Yes, absolutely.
Just got out of church. I was looking at this gentleman in the blue jumpsuit, the American flag, the NASA insignias, and behind you was the screen of you up above the planet in zero gravity. I know that there's more technical terms than that, but just you guys just floating around. And I know that you're from Scotland, South Dakota, that you're a South Dakota boy. And somehow, as an artist would do, I looked through and I tried to see you as a young boy, and I wasn't all that far off, I understand. I could see you kind of like a Harvey Dunn painting out on the prairie, and you said you used to thrash, right?
Well, I did thrash one season. Most of the time we had combining, we combined the oats, but what I did spend one summer where I helped two or three families thrash. So I have tossed plenty of bundles.
And I could picture you with that grass. You always have to have that grass seed that you chew on. You ever notice those guys?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And looking off into the distance, maybe seeing an old airplane in those days, saying, one day I'd like to be higher than that. And I think that you have really reached probably what we always think of in the American dream, that you have reached out, and it wasn't by luck. I know that you've studied very hard. We were joking about West Point, but you just don't get through there, right? You don't get through there just by goofing off.
Well, it takes a certain amount of work.
Now, right out of West Point, and I'm really sorry to say that our time is just slipping by, and we don't really have all that much time left. What was your first assignment? Do you remember?
My first assignment out of West Point?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I went through the infantry officer basic course at Fort Benning, Georgia, which is again, our basic course. I was a mech infantry officer, and then shortly after that, I went to flight school. And then my first assignment to an organization after that was 24th Infantry Division in Savannah, Georgia, Fort Stewart, Georgia, and ultimately, which was going to be commanded by General Norman Schwarzkopf.
Wow. Did you ever have to go overseas for anything?
No, as it turned out, I've been very fortunate to spend all my time here in CONUS, U.S.
So I could just picture somewhere down the line you must have complained, geez, I never get out of the country. Look at it, I joined the Army to see the world, never got out of the country.
Well, that's right. It took me 2.5 million miles on my last flight to get back from the exact same place I'd started from.
This is funny because you not only got out of the country, you literally left our world.
Well, that's right. Sometimes that realization is hard to imagine.
Well, you are here, and you're for real. Now, at what point, we have a family?
Yes, yeah.
At what point did that happen?
Well, I was married in 85. I've got a son that's 19 months, and a son, Grant.
And his name?
Grant.
Okay.
And a daughter, Ashley, who's about 5 weeks old.
Oh, and your wife, where she's from?
She's from originally from Savannah, Georgia.
And her maiden name?
Charlene Stringer, and she grew up in Savannah in Georgia.
And you live, is it down in Texas?
Yeah, right now we're living in a small town called Nassau Bay, Texas.
Let's go back to Scotland. Let's talk about some of your friends down there. Who'd you buddy around with?
Well, there's lots of guys, and I tell you, for fear of of not making anyone disappointed or mad, we all kind of chummed around. You remember, we all went to school. Most of us went to school for 13 years together. We all became friends, and I maintained those friendships through the years. I've got many classmates there that are still in town, both out in the farming community, as well as businessmen downtown. So it's been fun over the years.
How big was the class of 1973?
Well, I believe our class total, I think our size was 70 or 71. I forget exactly how many we graduated. It was the largest class that we'd ever graduated from Scotland High School.
besides an astronaut, what all came out of that class? So you got quite a bit of diversity. You got some...
Oh, we've got a state's attorney for Hutchinson County. We've got a banker there in Scotland. We've got accountants that work for firms across the country. We've got successful farmers, ranchers, businessmen. So we've really, we've got a very diverse group, I think.
I used to teach, so I love throwing this question out. Who was your best teacher? You don't particularly have to say the name. You can just say the subjects or the name. I'm sure they'd be proud to hear it.
Well, I think probably the best educator that I ran into, and I'm not afraid to give his name, was a guy by the name of Dr. Henry Ferry. He now is retired from the Army. He's a retired colonel and working now for an engineering firm in Denver, Colorado. But he, by far, was probably the most influential educator and assisted me in developing the major and the curriculum that was going to ultimately prepare me for this job. Of course, all through school, there's many of the teachers that of course were very colorful, and I had and I remember very fondly.
Could you mention a few?
Oh, well, I mean, there's Mr. Crosby, Arlene, and Jim Hookies, Jim Schneiders that live here in Huron. We had, just the list goes on and on. Harold Setches, Len Bellick, who's here from Huron.
Oh, Len? You had Len?
Oh, sure, yeah.
He taught band, didn't he?
He taught band.
Were you in band?
Yes, I was.
Oh, hey, great. I've known Len for a long time. See, he's a drummer, too.
Well, I guess he played all the instruments when I was around, so I didn't know that he started out as a drummer.
Were you in, like, drama, chorus, or any of the extracurricular activities, sports?
Well, I was involved in, all those things. Did a little bit in drama, did some debate, a little bit of cross-country and golf.
I like this one now. Who was the toughest teacher you had?
Ooh, the toughest teacher I had. That's a tough one.
Possibly out of all the times you've been interviewed, Colonel, throughout the world, am I the first one to ask you that?
I think the toughest teacher that I remember was as tough was Arlene Hookie. She was my fifth grade teacher, and I'll tell you what, she ruled with an iron fist.
And I'll bet you learned a great deal from her.
Yeah, we had a good class.
Do you want to say hello to the people back there? You were saying some wonderful things during the break there. Why don't you just say hello to them and tell them the things that you told me?
Well, you bet, Chuck. I would like to have the opportunity to say hello, particularly people of Scotland and all South Dakotans as far as that goes. Really... When you're up in orbit and orbiting this world, and you know that everybody's down here, one of the things that makes it well worth it is the fact that you know that you have the support of the American people and your friends and neighbors back home. But growing up, the mentors that I had growing up were the people around me. I didn't idolize baseball players or football players or other public figures. I guess the people I looked to as mentors were the businessmen, the educators, the clergy, and certainly my parents and brothers and sisters back home. So those are the people really that shaped my life as it's become.
Lieutenant Colonel Gamer, it's just been fantastic. We want to thank our listeners, especially our new listeners today. Our program is produced in the studios of KOKK here in South Dakota. So if you have any comments or recommendations for guests on our show, we may be reached at that radio station. That's Chuck Anderson, KOKK, here in South Dakota. We want to thank our guest today, Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Sam. Why do they say Sam? It's in all of your biographies, your bio.
Sam is a nickname I picked up in college.
Okay, Chuck Sam Gamer. We want to thank the Colonel very much and the astronaut. This is Chuck Anderson saying thanks for listening. Have a great and successful week.